Okay, so my title is Quantum and Classical Anomalies, so I'm going to start off with stuff which is quantum, but was really ancient. I mean, this is going to be prehistory for most of you. And in fact, I'm going to be describing stuff that I should have understood when it took place, because I'm quite ancient now. But then I'll get on to more recent stuff, which is relevant to what we're interested in with regard to, say, the connection between the surface and bulk states in interesting insulators. So I'll just show some references. What I'm talking about is going to be loosely based on stuff that's in these papers, which, of course, you can find easily enough. So I only put it up to advertise the fact that I'm working with a new graduate student. He's only started working with me in the spring. We've already written two papers and are working on a third. He's really good, so you'll hear more of him. So the basic outline is I'm going to talk about, as I say, ancient history, about why we have anomalies, right? Anomalies has a particular meaning in particle physics, the Adler-Bardeen-Jakif anomaly, and I'm going to be talking about that, and I'll try and motivate it from the viewpoint of a condensed matter physics, and in particular, this thing called the Callan-Harvey effect, which is really what we do when we say that the bulk and surface of our topological insulators are connected in some way. And what I really want to come to is a story which is to say, ancient, the issue of consistent versus covariant anomalies, which is when you read the physics literature on these things, even the recent book by Bartleman, I think they give rather the wrong impression about this. So my aim is to be pedagogical and explain my own view on that. And maybe if somebody here would disagree with me, then we can have a good debate. And then I want to come to the more recent stuff, which is, I'll describe it as we come to it. So I won't give two talks. Right? So let's go back to 1981, when Goldstone and Wilczek wrote a very nice paper. And they were interested in the 1 plus 1 dimensional Dirac equation. In those days, I'd have called it the two-dimensional one because we worked in space-time, but now we work in space, and so it's a one-dimensional equation, and I write the Hamiltonian rather than the Lagrangian expression. So I've got a differential operator, which is a one-dimensional Dirac equation for things moving at the speed of light, but they have a gap delta, and the gap has, you can open up a gap with one of these things with two terms, sigma 1 and sigma 2. We may as well put them together into an angle. And Goldstone and Wilczek said that if you take this system and you think about it just as a Dirac system and you fill all the negative energy C's up and you calculate the density in the filled ground state and the currents, then there's a simple formula for them in terms of the derivatives, the x derivative and t derivative of theta. They're approximate, but actually they are remarkably good because the corrections to this are total derivatives. So if you want to calculate the total accumulated charge, it's given by the change of the angles from the two sides. And the reason that works is that this is really an adiabatic approximation. And if you move slowly enough, then this is arbitrarily good. So this was used pretty quickly in condensed matter physics. This is really the beginning of topology in that area. So you can use this as a simple model for a charge density wave. You have a particle moving in a line, energy p squared over 2m, and you add a periodic perturbation, which couples the two Fermi points together, you open up a gap, and that's what this is. And the theta will vary with position, means you haven't quite gone across from one point to the other, but you missed a little bit. And if it's theta varies with time, that means the charge density wave is sliding. And so these are the formulae that told us that the sliding charge density wave produced a current. And in the case of polyacetylene, which, as I say, was really the beginning, the first time people started thinking about topology, in electrons as opposed to cathodifying defects, that was the thing that told you that the mid-gap state in polyacetylene ignoring spin had charge a half. And so it was the beginning of a large game. But one of this thing, the simple equation has within it an adder that's lurking in the grass. Take this object and you can make a unitary transformation on the space that you're playing with, which looks completely innocent, and stick some term here with an exponential of sigma 3. For a particle physicist, sigma 3 is playing the role of gamma 5, so this would be something they'd call axial. And just take it through here. The theta is going to depend on position in general, and it cancels this term. Right, there's only half of it here, but when you slide this through the sigma 1, this comes another minus, eats that completely, giving you a thing that doesn't depend on position, but adds a term which is proportional to the identity matrix, which is basically like a potential. So it's clear that if I make this phase angle vary with time, sorry, this position, it's the same as adding a potential. That sounds perfectly straightforward, but it's not true. Okay, so but. So let's come to the actual physical model that we might want to think about with this. As again, I was saying, what you can think of this as being the surface of the valence band. You've got a one-dimensional system. You've opened up a gap in some particular way. And so that the model you'll have is a filled valence band, an empty conduction band. And you ask yourself, what's the difference between these two things that I did, one of which was twisting the theta and the other of which was adding a potential? And if you've got a gapped insulator and you do this twist, what you're doing is the area you're gapping is slightly smaller and you reduce the number of states that are sitting there. So I'm imagining that theta is constant out here and then starts twisting at some particular rate. And as a result of that, the bottom of the valence band is untouched because I'm not doing anything near there. This is a very small perturbation just near KF. It's only because it's a degenerate point that it has an effect at all. The bottom of the band doesn't care about it. So you see you've just got a narrower band here, and there are fewer states, and it's easy to calculate how many fewer states there are, and it tells you it's exactly that, minus 2 pi over the gradient of theta. On the other hand, if you add a potential, this is an insulator, if you add a potential and the potential that you've added is smaller than the band gap, you're not going to induce any local charge at all, and so what you're actually doing is you're bending the band, as you normally think of in semiconductor physics, and this guy has been bent down, so is this one, but now the width of this and the width of that are the same, and so there isn't any change in the charge. And so the fact that in one case you've got something staying the same, in the other case this guy is sticking down there, means that basically the regulator at the bottom of the Fermi C has destroyed the symmetry. And so this chiral symmetry that you thought was there is really not a physical symmetry. It's been destroyed by the bottom of the Fermi C existing. Okay, so in particle physics, you can have bottomless Fermi Cs. In condensed matter physics, we usually have a bottom, right? Okay, so now we can build up on this and go up one dimension, so two space dimensions. And again, this is a standard story that I think everybody knows, but I just want to tell the tale again. Okay, so we can imagine having a two-dimensional thing. So now we've got a sigma 3 in the x direction, a sigma 2 in the y direction, and we gap the system with a mass term proportional to sigma 1, and we arrange for it to change sign from positive to negative as we go across there. And we also notice, of course, that I've set the system up so that it's translationally invariant in the y direction. So I can look at states which have an e to the I ky. That just replaces this sigma 2 d by dy by a ky times sigma 2. And then you can ask yourself, what are the energies of the system? And one of them you'll discover there's a state which has energy that's precisely equal to ky. Which is localized, provided I get the masses right here. So if the mass is negative in the positive region, this wave decays this way and it decays that way, and so on. So this is one of these standard surface states of the type that we're very familiar with in topological insulators. Usually we think of one of these sides as being the vacuum and the other side as being the case which has an inverted band and so on. So now we apply an electric field parallel here in the y direction and ask ourselves what happens at the Fermi surface. So again, it's easy to do that. You just add minimal coupling and arrange for that to vary with t. And again, we've got an e to the I ky state. So all that's happening basically is ky is being replaced by ky plus et. And so if you're sitting here and you've occupied one of these states, and as time goes on, this state gradually increases in energy. So the energy is proportional to k, and k is going to et. And so if you had a filled C originally, you're now getting more and more particles appearing there. And so particles are appearing from nowhere out of the vacuum. If you're if you're just sitting in this universe, you're in a one-dimensional universe, you don't know about the higher dimensions. You just think the particles are popping in out of nowhere. And as a result of that, the conservation law of the current along the axis here, that J0 is just rho, JY is the current, that's given by a rate. I put an E in here so that the current is really E times the particle number. The second E is because it's EE that couples to it. And the 1 over 2 pi is the same as this 2 pi. Okay, so that's the origin of the 1 plus 1 dimensional anomaly. It's very simple. And if you're a particle physicist, you're probably content with this. You might try and gauge it and discover that you can't do so. But these particles are just appearing from the infinite Fermi C. It's like Hilbert's hotel. There's an infinite supply of these guys. They can keep coming up and so on. And you don't worry about that. But in solid state, we don't have that option. So the question is, where are these particles coming from? They can't be coming from the infinitely deep Fermi C because it's got a bottom. But now we can look back at this particular expression here, and you notice that the sigma 2 was this thing that was the ky plus et. So what's happening is basically the size of this term versus that one is changing with time, and so we can use the d by dt theta formula to calculate how much current is flowing around in the system. And here we're in the, we're not just sitting on this domain wall anymore, we're sitting in the, within the box, we're really doing the two-dimensional system, but we're just calculating the ky, the x current in, for each of these kys independently. And if you take the derivative here, the d by dt over t, you get something that you can do, and you can add up all those ones for every k. Again, you have a dk over 2 pi to add them up, and all the other factors here. Yep. Oh, I've only got left things going in one direction here. This is purely chiral, right? Yes, but there's two ways. There's different ways of looking at it. If I look at the, if I think of a parabolic band and I apply an electric field, then I'm shifting the whole band, and so I'm gaining something on the right and losing something on the left, right? I haven't got another chiral current, you see. At this particular system, I've got only things going in one direction on this domain wall. Maybe if the mass term changes sign again, I'll have another one and something going in the other direction. But nearly everything I'm going to be talking about, I'm going to have just one chiral thing, just one vial thing. So there won't be simultaneous. It's an edge state, and it's not. There aren't going to be left and right goers. Okay? Yeah, you can add them up. And so, if I have a negative mass here and then it becomes positive again, I'll get two things. I'll get something going up here and something going down there. And people often quote it by calculating the current with a gamma 5 or a sigma 3, which just adds factors of 2 in various places. But actually, that's one of the things that's muddling in the particle physics literature, because people make vector conservation a holy cow. And that confuses quite a bit of the literature as they struggle to maintain that. Under circumstances when it's not quite tenable. So let me keep going on this. So the point is that you can use the Goldstone-Wilczek stuff. You could do these anomalies without actually doing Feynman diagrams, right? You only need to know how the density of states in systems, and that's just how that's coming further on. So I add this. So I find I've got a current which depends on the sign of the mass. This is the parity anomaly. Same expressions, a 1 over 4 pi. We had before a 1 over 2 pi, but of course this guy has two sides. And so what's happening is you're getting more stuff coming here, but the extra stuff is actually flowing in from the outside. Okay, so it's not coming in from the bottom of the Fermi C, it's coming in from the outside, because these guys simply don't know that there's an extra universe out there, but we do. Right? So I've always thought the fact that the weak interactions interact only with left-going quarks is kind of a strong hint that there are particles living on a domain, that's us, and there's an outside universe. But that's brains, right? So, okay, so this idea was first made clear, as far as I'm aware, by Callan and Harvey in 1985, and they were doing string theory. They were interested in stuff flowing into strings, and I think some of their calculations were in 11 dimensions and so on. But they also did lower dimensional cases. They looked at particularly chiral strings in ordinary space-time that could be cosmological and asked about stuff flowing into them. But people started doing this, using this for condensed matter physics almost straight away. I tried Googling early things to find them out and found that we seem to be some of the earliest ones. So with Paul Mizikar and Anupam Garg, I should explain my history here. I came to Urbana as a lattice gauge theorist, right? So I was doing large-scale numerical calculations and so on. But I ended up sharing an apartment with Paul Mizikar, who's an expert on helium-3. And then after he left, I shared with Wu-Pei Su, of the Su-Schrieffer-Higgins model. So by the time they had left, I decided I should join the majority in Urbana and move over. Right. Okay. So we looked at some of the paradoxes in helium-3a. And helium-3a is interesting because the gap structure on the surface has nodes. And in the neighborhood of the nodes, the energy dispersion looks just like a Dirac or a Weyl cone, right? So we realized that when you try to move this around, you automatically get extra quasi-particles produced, and when you included that, you realize that quite a lot of the things that were problematical went away. So there's various other people doing it, and Grisha Volovic started looking at the same thing from 1989. Grisha, of course, is one of the people we learned a lot of topology and solid state and condensed matter from, and he was started thinking about the flow of momentum into vortices then, and so there's been many things. There's also various applications of this in the quantum Hall effect. We all know that the edge bulk connection is an application of the anomaly. Various people have done it to look at skirmions in the fractional quantum Hall states. At the same time, Eduardo and Elbio and Daniel Boyanowski started thinking about real solids, lead telluride in particular, and they said that maybe that would have interesting surface states. They didn't quite get the bands right, but it wasn't topological. The mass term didn't quite turn over, right? Yeah, but they weren't too far off, right? It's not lead telluride, but other tellurides, right? So there's a gap, right, till 2005, and then everybody starts writing about this. Okay. So, but the point is that people were thinking about these kind of inflow Callan-Harvey effects in the solid state game for quite a long time, and there were things that we thought we understood, but haven't really realized we didn't completely understand it until recently. So I always rather like, even though one's usually dealing with abelian symmetries, I like to try to cast things in a non-abelian fashion, simply because the added structure gives you more insight into what's going on. So this is some of the game we're playing here. So I just want to introduce some language which looks a little bit more complicated than I was doing before. So I'm going to imagine that I've got a gauge field. In this game, it's traditional to consider it as a one form, and it's matrix valued, so the lambdas are the generators of some group, maybe the SU2 sigmas, which should be called tau because they're flavor, not spin anymore, or the Gell-Mann lambdas if I'm dealing with SU3. And then there's a gauge transformation here where I have an inhomogeneous piece and also a piece where the thing just gets rotated by an adjoint transformation. And when you've got such a thing and you manage to integrate out all the fermions and you've got some effective action S, one of the ways of calculating what's the current flowing in there is asking yourself, if I make a small change in A, what is the coefficient of that, and that's the current. When you've got currents defined in systems and you're seeing charge disappear somewhere and appear somewhere else, there's more than one way that it can flow, right? And so when you derive currents by using Noether's theorem, they're often ambiguous, and that's an issue that we're going to have to address. But usually we can measure where the currents are in a solid by measuring the magnetic field that's produced. So you want to look at how does that couple to the gauge field you're interested in. And that leads to a very natural definition of the current in this way. So the J is the functional derivative of the effective action with respect to A. And if I make a gauge transformation, my effective action is supposed to be invariant under that. And so let's ask ourselves, what's the change in A when I do that? It's minus the covariant derivative of this infinitesimal parameter here, this being the definition of the covariant derivative. So if you try to see what's the variation in S, which should be zero, you just have here's the change in A, here is J, you can do an integration by parts, and you end up with this covariant derivative again. So you realize that the extent to which something isn't gauge invariant is related to whether or not this covariant derivative, covariant divergence of the current is equal to zero. So the covariant conservation of a current is the same thing as being gauge invariant. And the interesting thing is that we've just seen that we have cases where currents are not conserved, and so we can have systems that look quite innocent, which apparently do not satisfy gauge invariance, and therefore I would say don't make much sense physically. Okay. So this game was being played extensively in the early, in the 70s and 80s. Originally, Wes and Cimino wanted to study anomalies, and so they came up with the idea that they should try and find a functional whose variation would give you the anomaly. Their formulation was really rather complicated, but Ed Witten produced a much simpler way of looking at it. And the end result is that if you want to have a functional that you're going to differentiate and get the currents, it's going to have various forms. It can have pieces that you make out of a minimal coupling, right? That automatically produces gauge invariant terms and effective actions, right? So that's a standard thing. But you need some extra pieces if you're going to get the anomaly. One of them is a coupling of some degree of freedom. If we were dealing with a 1 plus 1 dimensional system, or a 2 plus 1 dimensional system with a 1 dimensional edge, you might think of G here as being a bosonized version of the edge fermion, Okay. In the case that they were interested in, the G was a matrix which was representing the masses of some system. You had, say, a left-handed fermion coupled to a gauge theory, a right-handed fermion that wasn't coupled to it, i.e. the weak interactions, and then you have something that makes a mass, spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking, and so there's a field there which includes in it, the, say, the pions if you just had two flavors, or the pions and kaons if you had three flavors. So you have this expression. So they also realized that in addition to that, and this was made clear by Ed Witten, you needed to somehow imagine that the space-time was a boundary of something. But this was just a mathematical trick then. So you imagine, for example, that the space-time that you were interested in was the surface of a sphere and it has some bulk, and you imagine extending this G throughout that bulk and add a term here which just looks like a winding term of the group over something. So in two dimensions, that would be this three-dimensional integral. In four dimensions, it's rather more complicated. And all this rest of this stuff, Witten originally figured it out basically by saying, what do I have to do to make it as gauge invariant as possible? So he did it all by hand and basically just kept adding terms until he got something that worked. And it was sufficiently complicated calculation that he got it wrong, right? So there's some factors of two wrong and some terms left out. In a minute, we'll see that this is straightforward. Okay, so now we've got some actions that we're going to differentiate. Now, before I just had an A, I didn't have a G. Here, I'm going to imagine these Gs obey an equation of motion. So when I make a small variation in them, that vanishes by virtue of the equations of motion. So I'm not going to mention that again. Okay, so you can go ahead and make variations of this thing. And of course, the magic of these terms, these winding number terms, is that if they have a boundary, this thing is this manifold of the boundary, the variation really can be integrated by parts. And lives only on the boundary. And so although I had expanded this G into the bulk, that was just a mathematical trick. The only thing that was important, but it doesn't matter how you do it, and that fixes the quantization. The coefficient of one of these terms has to be fixed. And Witten pointed out by looking at pi 0 to 2 gamma, I should just go back to particle physics, right? In the old days, people didn't know QCD, but they did know there were some symmetries, and they had a thing called current algebra. And a few other assumptions, and they could rigorously prove that the pi zero meson did not decay to two photons, which is embarrassing because that's its most popular decay mechanism. Okay, so however, it's now understood that that occurs because of the anomaly, and if you write these things out, there's a coupling term, and so it's an experimentally measured thing. And Witten pointed out that the coefficient that gave that had to be quantized. So actually, this was something that was calculable exactly in theory even before QCD, and the number had to be the number of colors. And the number came out experimentally to be 3, which is very good. So, okay, so we have these things. And again, you can calculate the current by taking a functional derivative and look for the anomaly. And so you just plug ahead and do this. I want to just write out one more equation here. Remember, the way I'm going to write all of these currents, these things are matrix valued. I'm going to pick off a particular term by taking a trace with the lambda. This is really just a metric on the group. I'm really just trying to lower an index down below here. So it depends on some metric on the group. Later on, I'll be talking about trying to get rid of traces and replacing them by integrals. And so if you see a trace in one of those formulae, it's just an excuse for raising or lowering an index. Okay. So you can go ahead and you can calculate. Now, we've got a formula for the abelian case, and just a reasonable guess would be that you just replace everything by gauge invariant expressions, and you'd end up in two dimensions with an anomaly for a single left-handed particle that looked like this. It's written out in terms of the field strength, which is the usual expression. The field strength has a thing. There's a factor of 2 in the definition here, which accounts for various factors of 2 that will appear and disappear in some of my formulae. If you think there's a factor of 2 missing, you'd have to check that this is included. The trouble is when you actually take the derivative of that West amino action, you get this expression, which doesn't have an F in here. It's anti-symmetric, so in the abelian case, you wouldn't notice there was a problem. But in the non-abelian case, there is, because it's not written out in terms of anything that's covariant. And also, there's actually a factor of 2 missing here, because there's two terms in the F here, and there's only one term here in the epsilon. So the factor of 2, and it's not gauge invariant. Same thing happens if you do this in three dimensions. This is your naive guess for it, and this is what you get from functionally differentiating that expression. So you'd say, well, they just got it wrong, right? But their attitude is that everybody else got it wrong. So when people calculated anomalies using Feynman diagrams, one group of people would get this, and Bill Bardeen would get this, okay? Phil being the son of John, right, and the brother of the James who's here. So there was an argument about that. But then Weston Zimino pointed out some fact that these things had to be coming from taking variations of an action principle. And if I do that, make a small gauge transformation, make another small gauge transformation, do them in the opposite order, it must be the same result as taking it with a commutator of the two. And these expressions satisfy that, and these expressions don't. Right, so the consistent anomaly is not gauge covariant, and in a sense that makes sense because the theory isn't gauge invariant, so why should any particular calculation be gauge invariant? Okay, so there was a belief that spread that the real anomalies were always these consistent anomalies, and the thing is still exists because we've just got a referee's report saying we got it wrong because we're using the covariant anomaly and not the consistent one. Okay, so I want to tell you why it's consistent is inconsistent. Okay, so that's going to be the aim for a little while. Okay, so let's go ahead. So at the same time that Bill Bardeen did these calculations, he noticed that if you take the currents that were derived this way, you could always add some simple polynomial in the A field, there was no G's involved, just the A field, to this guy. And similarly, you could do the same thing in four dimensions. You had this funny looking expression, which is clearly not gauge covariant. But if you add those guys in, then they automatically, you know, the covariant divergences of these and the covariant divergences of those add the missing terms. So you end up with a nice covariant expression. And that feels good. But you have to ask yourself, why am I allowed to add terms like that? Particle physicists never seem to worry about doing that. But there was a big dispute in the 80s over this. Because remember, we had these particles flowing across and more of them appearing. Nonetheless, the amount that's on the right-hand side of that equation, it's the anomaly, it's a total divergence. So you can always take that guy and add it to the current, and then you get something that's conserved, right? And so Rod Kreuther argued that that's what you should always do. All anomalies go away if you redefine the current in that particular way. See, the problem is in particle physics, there are no rules. You make them up. String theory is a great subject, but they keep changing the rules as they discover new things. But in solid-state physics, we have real physical systems that we can ask actual questions about, and there's an answer that's right or wrong, all right? So you can't change the rules. That's one of the reasons I must admit that I swapped side. I didn't like calculations. I didn't know what I was doing. Okay, so the question is adding these terms legitimate? Is there a place where they come from? If we're allowed to do that, are we allowed to add Kreuther's terms? And the answer is no, we're not allowed to add Kreuther's terms, but we are allowed to add these. And so I want to explain where they come from. And en route, we'll explain why you could find out what these Wessimino expressions were without doing the ad hoc calculations of just trying it and adding extra terms and canceling the bad bits by adding more terms that was used by Ed Witten. So by now we have this idea, right, that if stuff is appearing somewhere in some universe, i.e. the surface of our topological insulator, it's probably coming from somewhere in the bulk. And we know from the quantum Hall effect that one of the ways of describing that inflow is by adding a Chern-Simons term, right? I like Chern-Simons terms. You might remember that NSF review report saying that our work would be much better if we never mentioned the word Chern-Simons. Yes. So we could add a Chern-Simons term. And in three dimensions, the kind of minimal Chern-Simons term that makes sense on spheres is this 1 over 4 pi times this expression. I'm writing it in terms of A and F. Often you see A dA plus 2/3 A cubed, but I'd like to write it in terms of F. Yeah. In higher dimensions, it's a little more complicated. There appears to be an I here, but that all has to do with conventions of whether my generators are Hermitian or anti-Hermitian and so on. And these are supposed to describe the bulk, and they should describe the inflowing stuff. So now a miracle occurs, which is there in the early papers, but they never remark on it, right? It's in the early Wessimino papers, Zimino and Bardeen papers, that if you take the Chern-Simons term, and you add it to your Wessimino term, you just get the Chern-Simons term up to a gauge transformation. Remember the gauge transformation, right, as A goes to G to the minus 1 AG plus G to the minus 1 DG. Okay. And that's a very pretty fact, right? But so it was observed that it was used as a calculational tool in some of those early papers, but nobody said, you know, this extra dimension was fake in those days, right? So you didn't talk about it. So when you do that, then you get this expression. This guy is now obviously gauge invariant. So if I replace A by AH and I replace g by g to the minus 1 h, this goes to h, a to the h to the h to the minus 1 g, it stays the same, and so this guy doesn't change under such a gauge transformation. So I've automatically made a gauge invariant expression, right? So that's nice. So we now are accounting for the current conservation by means of the inflow from these Chern-Simons terms. That's nice. So let's look at calculate the actual current that's flowing in the system that comes from this extra term. So I have to take a functional derivative of this with respect to A, and we know that the whole thing was cooked up so that the D of the Chern-Simons term is F squared, and so on. And when you do this again, you get a simple answer. You get delta A times F squared. But whenever you calculate functional derivatives, of course, we always integrate by parts to take derivatives off things and put them somewhere else and integrate them out. We always have to explain to students why you have to do that when you do functional derivatives, right? And so you have to do that here, and there's an integrated out piece. There's not just a current in the bulk, there's also a contribution to the functional derivative of C that lives on the surface, and that looks slightly familiar, all right? So you've got this AFFF, there's a half here, and I had this expression here, which was there wasn't a half, but there are halves hidden in these apps, right? Okay. So it turns out that this extra piece here is exactly the Bardeen polynomial. So when you calculate the current that comes from this added piece, it makes a contribution to the current on the surface, right? So the Wessonino term didn't capture all of it, and these extra pieces are always the Bardeen polynomials, okay? So once you've got a consistent theory, i.e. it's gauge invariant, but it consists of a surface like the surface of our crystal, which has perhaps a single Dirac cone on it and a topological insulator in the bulk, as soon as I know that there's a bulk as well, then the current that I calculate on the surface is has this extra term, and the anomaly that tells me how much stuff is coming in is precisely the inflowing current here. This five is the fact that I'm imagining I've got a four-dimensional space, and the fifth dimension is perpendicular to it, and this is the current flowing in that perpendicular direction. And this is exactly the expression for the anomaly. If I have five here, and these one, two, three, four, once I drop the five, this is the expression that I was expecting to get, all right. Okay, so here's the story from the first half of my talk. It's taken half an hour, that's reasonable. So when the theory is physically consistent, in the sense that the new stuff that's coming in, that's from the anomalous conservation law, is coming in, then whenever you do make it consistent, then there's a term that comes from the boundary, and in all the cases that I know of, that is precisely the term that's required to cook up the current to being the one that obeys a covariant conservation law, which is reasonable since the theory is now gauge invariant, so the current should be gauge invariant. There's a similar calculation you can do. You can imagine circumstances in which you've got particles moving on the surface in a magnetic field, and you want to know what current should I couple to it when I'm calculating the change in energy momentum, right? And again, you can go through the arithmetic. It looks a little bit more complicated, but at the end of the day, you realize that the current that you're supposed to use when you calculate Lorentz forces is, again, a covariant expression. And then it's only when the theory is physically inconsistent and it's not gauge invariant can you use the consistent anomaly. Okay. Sorry. Yep.
And I want to understand the covariant anomaly is the points of the consistent anomaly. Mm-hmm. So let's put a quantum hole on the cylinder. If you look at this into one edge, so on the there are two edge. One
yes.
edge basically is left moving.
Yes, that's right.
The other edge is
yeah, so what so whatever's appearing on this side is disappearing from the other side.
So if I look into one edge, that's consistent anomaly. If I
no, I'm not sure of that. I think even if you're on one edge, so I've only got a one chiral fermion, right? And it's coupled to a gauge field. I'm claiming that if the theory is gauge invariant, then I should use the equation that's describing how much stuff is appearing there should be the covariant one.
Right. I kind of thought that covariance, like if you move to H, kind of a, you know, like cylinder, and move this to H, kind of join together. It's not really joined together, but it's moved closer.
And closer and closer.
Then covariant will be points of the
Oh no, the factors are different. The two is only in. Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. The factors are different. It's in different dimensions. But I don't think it's that. No, it's not just the factors. There is a factor of two, but it's not that factor of two.
So
it's a different factor of 2, and it's a different factor of 5 or something in 4 dimensions. All right. Okay, so now I'd like to come and talk about classical anomalies. And the motivation for doing this is really driven by what we usually do in condensed matter situations. When we're discussing a lot of solid state physics, for example, how a transistor works and so on, you simply say, I've got electrons that move around at a phase velocity that's given by dE dK, where E is the band energy and K is the momentum, and that K dot it responds in the same way that it does to the Lorentz force. It's proportional to the electric field, and V, its velocity cross the electric field. And we use these classical equations to describe what's going on. And in the anomalous case, it looks as if we've got some more issues that we have to address. And maybe it's not safe to use that simple picture. So what I want to argue is that actually it is safe under the right circumstances, and that you can basically get the right picture by doing the same thing that we normally do without having to do any complications. So imagine that we've got a situation, we've got our Dirac cone here. I've drawn, I've stolen from the web a picture of a Dirac cone from the 19th century. And the basic idea, right, is that in the middle here, there's this point that Michael Berry calls the diabolical point. This whole thing, of course, is a diablo. It's a game that you play on pieces of string and attach it around. And so the real picture that I'm interested in here is this. We've got something like graphene, but I'm more thinking actually of the surface states on where you have a single Dirac cone. You have the lower band that just touches a single point. This is filled. I'm going to call this the Dirac C. And then up here, we've got a system which has a Fermi surface, so it's reasonable to call this upper one the Fermi C. All right? And we can use semi-classical calculations, the ones that we normally use when we do these simple solid state pictures of how transistors work and how the electrons or holes move, out here quite safely. But close to the diabolical point, you have to be more quantum mechanical. So let me just say what's the standard tradition of the four-dimensional anomaly, right? So if you look at the expression, it looks complicated in terms of Fs, but it's actually this E dot B, where E is the electric field and B is the magnetic field. And so what's happening is that you imagine that you've got some region over which E and B are roughly constant, and because of the B and you've got a Dirac cone, you have Landau levels, and one of the Landau levels crosses zero, and it turns into exactly the same problem that we just dealt with in 1+1 dimensions. So that you get a contribution proportional to E, but the number of states that cross zero per unit area is given by the B factor, okay? So in principle, if you want to figure out how much stuff is flowing through this point when you have an E and B, you should solve a Landau level problem down there, and that's quantum mechanical, okay? On the other hand, we can, instead of doing that, we can just look and see how much stuff is flowing into the Fermi surface up here. And what we're making use of is the idea that the flows in classical mechanics are incompressible, right? So you have Liouville's theorem that says you have some flow in XP space, and the divergence of that flow is zero. What goes in has to come out. So if we know that there's stuff coming out at the top here, we know how much is flowing in from the Dirac C into the Fermi C, okay? So that's what I want to do. So it wasn't my idea, but I'll describe some classical mechanics first before we come on to actually doing the example. So the point is, I want to talk about classical mechanics and Liouville's theorem, right? So something that we all know, but I want to do it with a slightly different twist because the cases that we have here, the pre-symplectic expression has a time dependence in it because it's going to have an A field, and the A field can depend on time, okay? So imagine that somebody just gives you an action for 2n degrees of freedom, which you can think of as the coordinates on the phase space, and it's some expression which has a single time derivative, a Hamiltonian. These psi's in some sense are the p's and q's in my phase space, and this is a Hamiltonian action principle, but it's slightly more general than that. So I can take the equations of motion here, this particular combination of the derivatives of this is the thing that we'd call a symplectic form, and mechanics is decent if this is an invertible matrix. And the problems in gauge theories is that if you work out, you know, what A and the p's and p's, this is not invertible, but in our case, it's invertible. And then since this did pulse in time, there's an extra little piece that's not there. If this wasn't here, this would just be the standard form of Hamilton's equations. Okay. So I like to do all this stuff in differential form language, and if we didn't have differential forms, the algebra would be a nightmare. So I'm going to explain a little bit of that. So the symplectic form, right, is this expression with the omega matrix that I had there, a couple of things as a wedge product between these two guys. And I'm going to define another symplectic form, which is this one, which involves both the Hamiltonian and the time derivative of the eta expression. And this is another two form. And then I've got some velocity vector in phase space and time. So it's a kind of extended phase space. That tells me I'm moving it 1 second per second. And this tells me how fast I'm moving there. And then Hamilton's equations have this very simple form. But if I stick the contract this vector field into the symplectic form, I get zero. Okay. Usually you don't do this, you just use this form, and then you have I omega, this omega is equal to dh. But here it's more convenient to do this because of the time dependence in the system. Okay. So there's a volume in phase space that we normally do. When we do phase space integrals, we normally just do them with dp dq. But I've got 5 minutes before 40 or? Oh, all right, okay. So I'll speed up a little bit. Maybe I just won't cover what I want to do. So this is a phase space volume. And when you do integrals, you're supposed to do dp dq, but there could be another factor there, and there is, all right. And then Hamilton's equations tell me that the Lie derivative of this is zero, and this reduces to this kind of conservation law. There's a density of phase space, which is the Pfaffian of this matrix. That's essentially what this differential form is without the dt. And what's going to cause the anomaly is that this zero is going to be replaced because there's going to be some singularities in these forms. Okay. So a nice example was worked out, and this is what got us going, by Misha Stefanov, and I think his student, who I've not met. And they decided just to take a single vial cone coupled to an electromagnetic field, a potential, and a vector potential. And then the idea is to replace this kind of quantum mechanical thing, which is a differential equation, by a one particle Hamiltonian, which captures the same physics. Okay, that's the claim, all right? But there's no spin left in this picture. It's just a particle that's moving with some velocity k, but not quite k, and it's sitting at the point x. And it looks just like the ordinary expression. There's an energy that's proportional to the velocity. So that's the Hamiltonian. There's the usual px term. There's also the ax dot term. So this is the usual coupling to a particle. And the one thing that's different here is, as this particle moves because of the sigma, it's as if the spin is sitting in some magnetic field whose magnitude is k. And so if k changes, you're forcing the spin to precess. And so it's going to pick up a Berry phase. And that Berry phase, of course, is just encoding the gyroscopic properties of the spin. Right? So you have to add that in. And so this is the Berry phase, which has a pole right in the middle, of course, at that diabolical point. And so the curl of this guy, which I'll call little b, has this expression here. It's div b, and there's a 2 pi delta cubed. So remember that 2 pi. Okay. So now you can work out the equations of motion. And as usual, the momentum changes according to the Lorentz force. The one thing that's not obvious, of course, is that the velocity is not just a unit vector in direction of k, which is what you'd expect if you calculated the group velocity from the Hamiltonian. But it has this extra term, which goes back to 1954 to Karplus and Luttinger, who were interested in the anomalous magnetic anomalous quantum Hall effect. I should say this Karplus is not the Martin Karplus who won the Nobel Prize a couple of weeks ago in chemistry, but it's his older brother, Robert, right? So there's lots of brothers in this game, right? I mean, because we've got Bardeens and we've got Karplus's. Okay, so the point is that it was pointed out by Chen Niu and a whole bunch of people, and Chen's done lots of beautiful things with this, that the omega for this particular problem depends on B. It's not the standard expression. And so if you take that into account and go through the derivation of the Liouville theorem, taking into account this 2 pi here, then you find that the Liouville measure is not conserved. There's a source term right at the diabolical point with a magnitude that you can calculate, and its coefficient is what you expect. So you plug away, you define a phase space density, you impose a Boltzmann equation that what's occupied stays occupied as it moves around. You define a current by just weighting this guy with this, and remember to put the d omega here. I've only integrated over k, so this is a function of x. Use this equation, plug it in, and then it gives you what looks very much like the anomaly equation. There's a factor of this f, which is just how much stuff is there at the diabolical point. If stuff's going to flow through, there has to be stuff there to flow through, right? So as long as the Fermi C is filled there, this is one. Right, and so that gives you the expression for the anomaly. Okay, so that was what Stefanov and Yin did. And what we decided to do was to look at this in higher dimensions and to look at it in with the non-abelian case to see if we got the right expressions. Okay, and we can do that, but we need a more complicated action. So one of the issues here is I want to have a particle moving in a non-abelian gauge field. And it's difficult to write down source terms, you know, for non-abelian gauge fields because they're supposed to obey a covariant conservation law. And so we usually do that with Wilson lines because that makes it automatically gauge invariant. But if you want to do classical things, then you have to do something else. And how to do that was worked out by a gentleman called Wong in 1970. And it turns out that the same things basically were discovered by a whole bunch of mathematicians. So Kirillov here is standing for a whole bunch of different people, both Kirillov's father and Kirillov's son, Sorayo, and so on. But basically the idea is you introduce, you've got the gauge field, which is coupling to the motion here. You have to couple it to some degree of freedom, which is an internal degree of freedom, which is like an isospin vector. And also, in higher dimensions, the Berry phase is no longer just a phase because there's more than one state for a given value of k, so it's a non-abelian Berry phase. So you need to introduce a spin group in 2n minus 2 dimensions. That's quite complicated. In fact, it's 2n minus 2, right? We were in 3 dimensions and we just had an ordinary rotation, so you might have expected it to be the 3-dimensional rotation group, but it's the SO2. You're down some. So these guys, the equations for these g's are a little bit complicated, and they're not even well defined. That's one of these cases when the thing doesn't invert properly. So the real degrees of freedom, you have to make a quotient. Actually, the orbits of these parameters here, which are matrix-valued parameters, which tell you what representation you're in. This is bigger if you're in a bigger representation of the gauge group. This is bigger if you weren't in this fundamental representation, but a higher one. So you can plug away and derive the equations of motion. One of the standard things is that the matrices for the group end up being replaced by functions on that orbit space, and they have Poisson brackets which reproduce the commutation relations. You have equations of motion for the internal space, and you have equations of motion for the in real space. So these guys are really the Wong equations, and we have the slight additional thing that we have this Berry phase factor. So that's not in Wong's original papers. So you can go ahead, calculate all these differential forms. You end up with the gauge fields again, the dps and dx, that should be a k, dks and dx's. These guys with wiggles are the f's not being matrix valued, but instead of where the lambda is, they have the q. All right, so it's a complicated function. You go through the machinery, plug, 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 and this thing turns out to have a nice simple factorized expression. And if we were taking ordinary traces, this guy, which is the spin Berry phase, has a monopole at the origin. That's the analog of the way that works. But the ordinary gauge field is closed as it is. And so you end up with an anomaly equation. This is what you'd expect to get. What you actually get here has the same factors, but it has what I call a classical trace. Instead of taking a trace over these matrices, you have to integrate over the phase space. How long do I have?
You're over by about 5 minutes.
Can I just take one more slide and just say something about what those integrals are doing? Okay, so what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to do these traces, we're supposed to do these guys, and here are some examples of doing it to show you that it doesn't quite work. You only expect things to work in the classical regime, right? So if I take a representation, this is what this picture was about, it's of different representations of SU2. These are the formulae for the dimensions and things. If you actually do the classical traces, you lose all these lower powers. It's similarly in the dimensions. But there's a nice factor that was noticed by the mathematicians. There's a thing called the Weyl vector, which is half the sum of the positive roots. And if you shift the weight by that amount, then you get the right answers. Okay, so I should stop there. All right, so there's a conclusion. And there we go.